Hello, I'm Stephen Gray, and I'm sitting this afternoon in my home with two gentlemen who are Iboga ceremony leaders and have been doing this kind of work for quite a long time. I'm going to ask them to introduce themselves. And first of all, I'm going to call on Steve to introduce himself. Say, Steve, just if you would say a little bit about, you know, your background, how you got to why you, you know, to what you're doing now.
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm in my late 50s, and my original initiation was into a meditation practice, and that was in the early 70s. And so that was my introduction to experiences outside of the normal worldly experiences. And actually, previous to that, I had some experience of psychedelics as well, but the very profound experiences I had through meditation took me to places far beyond where the LSD had taken me to, and so I've had that practice. But about more than 20 years ago, maybe 22, 23 years ago, I started to work with ceremony with several different teachers, and went to Mexico and did a variety of different kinds of ceremonial work in Mexico, including working with mushrooms there. And then after that, I was working mainly in Europe. And my partner that I live with is a teacher of ceremonial medicine. So this is ceremony as medicine. And probably sometime in the last 10 years, I came across ayahuasca. And I'm not sure how many ceremonies I done with ayahuasca, but probably a couple of hundred, maybe. Probably 6 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, I met a group of French people through my friend Sean here, who were working with Iboga and had very strong connections with a shaman in Gabon. And so I worked as a helper in those ceremonies for a while, and meanwhile I was already running ayahuasca ceremonies in Europe with Sean, the two of us together. And when the French people stopped doing the ceremonies, then we looked at working with the Iboga ourselves, just us, and we thought, we have a lot of respect for it. We'll just wait and see on this one. And very quickly, we were joined by a Frenchman who'd also, as with Sean, had been out to Gabon and done an initiation out there. So then the three of us started up an Iboga practice together. That was several years ago. Mm-hmm. It's now just Sean and myself, and we have two or three other people who will assist us when we're working in various countries in Europe. But that's basically, you know, now we've been invited to Canada. Mm-hmm. I'm very pleased to say.
Yeah, good. And Sean, brief explanation of how you got to where you're doing this now?
Mm. Well, I'm not sure if there's any brief explanation about this experience. But it seems to be a life of many lives so far. Uh-huh. But I'm Sean. I was brought up as a Jehovah's Witness as a child.
Sorry to hear that.
And one of the teachings I was brought up with was that when I die, my soul returns to the dust with a body. And that death is like an eternal sleep. Mm-hmm. So I kind of figured, well, I enjoy sleeping, so I'm going to go out there and do everything you've told me that I shouldn't do. And And so I spent about 10 years trying to find myself through the extreme, pushing myself to the extremes. And then at some point, I smoked some DMT. And I had a realization within that experience of DMT that I had been basing my existence on a belief system, which was a lie. And in actual fact, there was something far vaster going on than I had been led to believe. So I had always had a strong calling before that. Even whilst I was a Jehovah's Witness, I never really fitted in with the doctrine. And so I'd always kind of felt that my master was within me, and that I was responding to the voice from within me. So when I had the experience with the DMT, it was very much a case of firming this into place. And then my calling started in earnest, and I'd already been working with substances up until then, but kind of more misguided. I'd been more working as a drug dealer, and but you know, feeling a really strong call from the plants, but not quite understanding how to facilitate my practice. And then I had a really strong calling to work with ayahuasca. And so I started to look to find a practitioner who was working with ayahuasca that suited me. And I couldn't find anyone at first. And then in the meantime, I did a session with Salvia divinorum, which is the sage. And I had a very intense experience with the sage.
How long ago was that?
That was probably about 12 years ago now.
Yeah, huh? Yeah.
And then when I had the experience with the sage, I went to bed that night. And then in the night, I had a dream that I was in the jungle. And these men took me through to a clearing. And in the clearing, there was this huge man sitting there. And he said to me, "Oh, Sean, you know, when you do, make sure that when you do your ritual with the ayahuasca, make sure you do it in a ceremony, in a ceremonial setting." So in the morning, I woke up and I was like, "Right, it's really clear. I'm going to look online," had a look online to see who is it that works with ayahuasca in ceremony. And then I found the UDV and the Santodaimi. But the only people who I could come into contact with was the Santodaimi.
This was where at this time?
I think this was in Holland.
Oh.
But they were having a big legal case at the time.
Right.
And not approachable. Mm. And then a friend of mine who was an investigative reporter tracked somebody down who was the partner of one of the organizers for the London group in the Santodaimi. So I called him up and invited myself along. And then when I went and did the session, I had an absolutely amazing session. And but when I went to the altar afterwards, I had a look on the altar and there was a really big photo of this huge black man.
Who the one you'd seen in your dream?
The one who I had seen in my dream.
Yeah.
And his name is Mestre Irineu.
Hmm.
And he was
from Brazil.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've read about him. Yeah.
That's right, yeah. So when
was this Santodaimi or Udibe?
That was the Santodaimi, yeah.
Yeah, and he was the founder of that, wasn't he?
He was the founder, yeah,
yeah,
and passed into spirit in 71.
Right.
So, yeah, so I kind of felt, oh yes, you know, all the bits of the puzzle started to fit into place.
Mm.
So I worked within the Santodaimi for about 5 years. And at the time, we were a small group, 15 to 25.
Yeah.
For the first 3.5 years, meeting regularly every couple of weeks, every couple of weeks, drinking for 2 days at a time, and lots and lots of sessions, and stayed the same size. And then after about 3.5 years, it started to expand. And after I'd been working with it for about 5 years, I had an opportunity. One of my teachers and friends, a chap called Gaston Saint-Pierre, who taught me metamorphic technique, came back from France one day and he said, "Oh, Sean, you know, I've just done this absolutely amazing experience in France with this wood. with Iboga. And he said that he bumped into somebody who he hadn't seen in a long time. And the last time he'd seen this guy had some real issues that he hadn't been able to let go of. But he'd seen him and his face was completely transformed. And he said, "Wow, you know, what's happened for you? How come you've made such a transformation?" And this guy said, "Oh, well, you know, actually I've done this Iboga cure down the road here." And it was where he'd done his cure was at the same place where my friend was about to run a workshop. So synchronicity took him there, met all these people, went and did the session, came back and said, "Here, you know, here, go and do this. This is really good, would be really appropriate for you." So I went along down there. I just jumped straight in without really looking into it. But the synchronicity of it was that I'd just done a 3-month cleanse. And on the last day of my cleanse, I went to France and I met all these French people, and none of them spoke English and I didn't speak any French. So they tried to explain to me at the beginning what it was about, but nobody could tell me anything. I couldn't hear anything. So all I could do was relax into the experience and experience it through my heart, without having my mind being able to come in.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this experience of meeting the wood. And when I met the wood was so happy to see me. It was like, "Oh, Sean, so fantastic that you've come." And it was really happy that I'd been working with the ayahuasca. And it showed me and said, "Look, your head's completely open to the astral, completely clear connection to the astral, but you've got no connection to the earth. And through me, I'm making you a tree with roots deep into the earth and your branches open to the heavens and a clear channel for universal consciousness." And this has been my experience. So I had an absolutely awe-inspiring session with it on that weekend. And when I stepped away from it, I realized that it was such an amazing medicine and it was so compatible for what I'd been receiving within the ayahuasca, that to be stepping into the wood now was grounding my practice into the physical and enabling me to experience what I knew was within me is also all around me. So, yeah, so basically I got speaking to the doctor who's running it, and we arranged that I would start bringing people over from the UK to do sessions. And I think
in France,
yeah. Bringing people over from the ayahuasca community.
Mm-hmm. This is before you hooked up with Steve?
Yeah. So for about a year and a half, every month I was taking 2 groups of people over, sometimes up to 10 people, taking them through all their preparation beforehand, being there for the journey, and then sort of being there for their aftercare afterwards. But most of the people are already very mature in their spiritual process, you know, having been working with the ayahuasca and then stepping into the wood. And and that was the journey for about a year and a half, taking loads of people over. And then I started to bring people over to the UK. So we had the French crew coming over to the UK and I was hosting them in the UK. And we used to run really big sessions. We used to have about 11 people come in and receive a cure. We'd have up to about 25 people assisting.
Mm-hmm.
And then behind the altar, sometimes we'd have up to about 12 people sitting behind the altar.
Mm.
Gangas and
Mabundis.
Yeah.
And and that was about then that Steve and I started to work together more within the wood. So Steve was coming in and running the kitchen. And
running
I was
the what?
Running the kitchen.
The kitchen, oh, yeah.
And I guess we were kind of running the floor space. So whilst the French crew were doing the ceremonial bit, we were...
Dealing with the casualties.
Yeah, so maybe this is a good opportunity for me to ask, and maybe you want to take this one, Steve, or it doesn't matter, but you know, maybe just describe a little bit about how you do these ceremonies, you know, how they unfold,
sure.
The nature of them is, what how the work goes, and etc.
It's a really clear design, if you like, for the ceremony, in that there's a death and a rebirth. So it's 3 days and two nights. The first night is the death. During the middle day, people are very much in the bardos.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the evening of the second day, that's when we need to start bringing people back. Because if we don't bring them back, they can be gone for a long time. And sometimes it's really difficult for people to find their way back. And I've met people who have worked with this medicine on their own,
mm-hmm.
not understanding how strong it was,
mm-hmm.
And how long the journey was. And one guy, you know, he told me, this was somebody with a regular meditation practice,
mm-hmm.
every day for, I mean, he'd been practicing for about 30 years. So he, you know, he's a grounded guy. But it took him 2 months to feel like he was back in his body.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, it's a serious business running an Iboga ceremony. And so on that second night, that's when we bring people back.
Yeah.
And we bring them back through dance.
This is similar to the way it's done in West Africa too, right?
It is very similar,
yeah.
The components are very similar. It just makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, people leave their bodies, basically. They're working somewhere else.
This is hence the term bardo, is that
why
you use
exactly,
that? Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Because it's, if you read the description of the bardos,
yeah.
then this is the kind of place that people are in. For the whole of that second day,
right. For the sort of the detail part of it, they eat the medicine evening of the first day.
That's right.
Right,
yeah.
And
yeah.
And then throughout that whole night and the next day, they're in the grip,
yeah.
full grip of the medicine.
They're dead, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Often the room is completely silent for hours.
Yeah.
Very, very silent.
And when you say they're gone, if I were to interview, you know, participants coming out of one of these, would they say that they had something akin to an out-of-body experience? Do they feel like they're actually truly gone into some other realm and not in their bodies, really?
You'll find that, as with any other medicine, everybody has their own experience of it.
But in general, it tends to feel like they're truly in another realm.
It's the longest day of your life when you do that. Yeah, yeah.
But still in a body.
Yeah.
Because the moment they open their eyes, they're conscious that they're in a body.
Yeah.
Mm. Mm.
And the thing with it is that they're having their DNA restructured according to their intent,
mm-hmm.
which is a really deep operation that takes place.
Now, do they have to be conscious of their intent coming in?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Do you do... intention sharing stuff.
Yeah.
What
we do is we make sure that everybody has a full consultation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. First of all, to find out if it's okay for these people to actually come into a ceremony, because some people, you know, won't be suitable to come and work.
So this
with
is
us.
Before they even come.
Oh yeah.
Like
yeah.
a phone conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
If yeah, 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 yeah. An hour or so conversation to really get through to, you know, why, you know, why have you been pulled in towards this experience, and we really want to kind of we really want to get to know them.
And how often would you actually have to turn somebody away based on that initial consultation?
Well, what tends to happen with it is that when we do the consultation, it's the recognition that what is happening within that consultation is that the presence of the wood is stepping into them.
Mm.
And then the presence starts to speak to them through their reality.
Mm.
Just
in the conversation you're having with them?
Yeah, you have the conversation and the conversation. The consultation is a reading as
mm-hmm,
well.
Mm-hmm.
And we basically introduce them to the wood through the consultation.
Even if it's on the telephone?
Yeah,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah. And then, I mean, it often happens for psychic people. And whilst we were having the conversation, they'll say, oh, there's this extremely large black man who's just walked into my living room. And he's sitting here with me. Has he got anything to do with you? And it's, oh, yeah, meet the Bwiti. Because then what happens is the Bwiti starts to speak to them through their reality.
So by the time they're done with this consultation, they've pretty much answered their own question as to whether they're ready for it. Is that the idea?
Well,
yeah, kind of.
I mean, the thing is, it's about self-inquiry.
Yeah.
So who are you and why do you feel called to do this work?
Well, my experience with intention setting and ayahuasca ceremonies is that it's difficult for a lot of us to really identify what our true intention is. You know, we come in with a number of different needs and, you know, do you find that challenging to bring people to where they're really clear about what their intention is?
Well, that's why it's important to have the consultation some weeks before the ceremony, ideally.
Right.
It's not always the case that it's needed. It really isn't always the case. But sometimes it is. And because as soon as they start to have the consultation, and as soon as they actually, it's like that's the step. They've said, yes, I want to do this. And that's when the aboga becomes present for them. And so they will begin to have things come to the surface, and it will be quite challenging for some people. But during that time between the consultation and the actual ceremony, and usually, in fact, always these days, they get another short consultation just before the ceremony. So everybody has a little bit of time just before the ceremony. So we speak to them again then. And we're really just trying to clarify things for them, help them to get to it. But my own experience was that I had all these different aspects of my life which I knew I wanted to change. But I also understood that there would be, they were like branches of a root, of a plant, if you like, and there was a main, one main root. And so what happens is by the time they come round to doing the ceremony, people are pretty clear about what the root is. And we're really, from that point on, once they have spoken their intent, once they're clear about it and they've spoken their intent, then it's just relax. Relax. Now you've said your intent, relax. Allow the plant to come in and do the work that needs to be done. You don't have to do anything. You can just lie back and allow the plant to do its work and know that that it's under the direction of your higher self.
Does it tend to come on slowly? Like, for example, with ayahuasca, it can sometimes come on like that and like a freight train and just bowl you over.
Yeah, it can
and
do
it can
that.
Be very difficult for people to ride with that at the beginning, you know, and that's where often the shaman's songs and interventions come in to help people through
too.
Yeah,
the iboga is very different to the ayahuasca, though. It's a very different experience. And there isn't really much, there's not much wriggle room with the iboga. So whether you go in slowly or quickly, well, once you're in there, you're on the fast train.
Right.
And there's no getting off.
I think just to mention as well that with a consultation, my experience of the Bwiti, which is the energy that we're working with.
The Bwiti, by the way, most people have never heard the word. I just want to say it's the name of the religion in Gabon and perhaps some other surrounding countries. Is that correct?
That's right,
I've read that there are perhaps 2 to 3 million members of the Bwiti religion in that area.
Yeah, my own personal experience of the Bwiti is that I experience my essence's emptiness. And my life practice and my ceremonial practice is one of nothingness. That I'm letting go into nothingness. And as I'm letting go into nothingness, I'm letting go of everything. So all the aspects that arise to the surface, I'm letting go of. And when I'm letting go of everything and letting go into nothingness, then there's a pure intelligence which is emanating from nothingness. And this pure intelligence, which, you know, sometimes when we're speaking in the medicine, I sometimes speak about, you know, it can be like Holy Spirit or higher self.
Mm-hmm.
Then this pure intelligence is then able to potentiate through me. And my experience of Bhuiti is that Bhuiti and this pure intelligence is the same expression. So when I'm working with Iboga, I've experienced that Iboga is the channel that grounds me into the Bhuiti. And when people come and have a consultation, it's this relationship with the Bhuiti that they're coming into. So they have their consultation, and then the Bhuiti starts to speak to them through their reality. And it brings to surface all those aspects where they're not grounded, all those parts of their lives that they don't take responsibility for. Brings them up the surface. So we get to see the leaves and we get to see the shoot of the weed.
And you're still talking about just in the consultation now?
This is once they've had the consultation.
Right.
And they've stepped back into their reality.
Oh, this is still before the ceremony. They go through all this.
Before the ceremony,
really?
Yeah.
Mm. Very interesting.
So,
yeah.
So all the aspects that keep them in their experience of separation come up to the surface.
Mm.
So all the suffering comes up to surface, all the fear comes up to surface. And when people are coming in, and maybe they're not quite so experienced with their spiritual journey, then we'll get them to record it, to write it all down, so that they basically have a sheet of paper and they get to see all their suffering. But of course, underneath all the suffering, once you've got it all down, you start to see that underneath all of the suffering is a root. And it's that root that we're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
Because then by the time people come in for the session, they already know the expression of the wood. They know how this presence is speaking to them. They know what it is that they're letting go of, and they know what it is that they're letting go into.
Fascinating. Mm. Yeah. I'm just going to stop here for a moment and divide this interview into like two or three sections so that people that need to take a break or don't want to digest the whole thing all at once have that opportunity. So I'm going to call this part one and stop it for a moment.